And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, June 17th. 61 degrees currently in Old Town Park City. No word from Cedric Haynes this morning. So I'll tell you that National Weather Service is telling us to expect sunshine today, a high of 76 with an overnight low of 51 tonight. Warming up to 85 under mostly sunny skies for Wednesday, hitting the 90-degree mark by Thursday, tapering off a bit on Friday with a high of 87, a little bit cooler on Saturday with a high of 82, overnight lows staying into the mid to upper 50s. Heber City currently reporting 60 degrees at the airport, looking for sunshine and a high of 83 today. Enjoy those cooler temps because warming right back up, clear tonight, 43 is the overnight low, sunny and 90 on Wednesday, 96 for Thursday, 93 on Friday, back down to 89 for Saturday. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the KPCW Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Later on, Summit County historian Sandra Morrison and Speaker Sonia Nordstrom with details on Saturday's free lecture taking place at the historic Echo Church, talking about locating unmarked graves. Finally, Recycle Utah General Manager Jim Bedell with the latest on a location for a new center. Taking a look at some local news now, Wasatch County School District Assistant Superintendent Garrick Peterson will be promoted to the district's top job. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports he succeeds retiring Superintendent Paul Sweat.
Members of the Wasatch County School District Board of Education announced Monday afternoon they've tapped Garrick Peterson to be the new superintendent. Peterson has worked in education for 2 decades, including 6 years in Wasatch County, and before that as a history teacher and administrator in the Alpine School District. School Board President Kim Dickerson says the district hired Peterson after a rigorous nationwide search led by the Utah School Boards Association.
He stood out in every phase, not just for his leadership within our district over the past 6 years, but also for his statewide and national reputation as one of today's most visionary and respected educational leaders.
To pick a new leader, a committee of 25 community members screened 12 candidates. 5 of those progressed to an interview with the school board, and 2 finalists underwent another round of questions from teachers and district leaders. School board member Brad Ellert says he did not expect his first choice to be an internal candidate, but Peterson impressed him.
I think the process really brought forward the best candidate for the role in the district right now. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Peterson's experience is allowing us to kind of catapult us from where we are today to the next level.
Business administrator Jason Watt described Peterson as a mellow, calm thinker and a decisive leader who will move the district forward. Peterson is also a parent with a daughter entering 9th grade and a son going into 11th grade. He said he strives to make decisions for the district's thousands of students the way he would for his own children.
I think whenever you have kids and you see how every kid has their hopes and their dreams, and you just want everyone to support them in that. Mm-hmm. And so I want us to be that for as many kids as we possibly can.
He said what drew him to the job was his deep respect for and belief in the district's teachers and staff. Peterson said he will prioritize relationships and openness as he steps into his new role. Outgoing Superintendent Paul Sweat said Monday he's looking forward to Peterson's leadership.
No one in this room is more happy and excited about the results of this nationwide search and very thorough process than I am. And as I walk out the door with Dr. Jason Watt being in the office upstairs next to mine, and Dr. Gary Peterson taking over my office and my responsibilities, that's heaven to me.
Sweat announced in April he's bidding the district farewell after 34 years. Peterson starts his new job July 1st. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday starting at 4 o'clock, and on the phone with a preview of the meeting, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, before we get into the agenda, let's talk about the recent joint meeting County Council held with Heber City Council. What are the main ways in which Heber's priorities differ from the county's, do you think?
I think overall Wasatch County's priorities are broader in that they literally cover a larger area. But I think we also try to pay attention to a more variety of issues. Heber City is focused on Heber City specific issues, and that's development issues, that's services within the boundaries that they have. But Wasatch County has responsibility for things that cross jurisdictional lines and even extend out beyond the state.
Mm-hmm. County council members had said that more interlocal meetings are a priority. So any other meetings that are planned at this point?
Yeah, we're looking to schedule a joint meeting summit county council. And I think we expect to try and meet with the Midway City Council soon. But we don't have that one scheduled yet. And we're going to kind of just make the rounds with all of the jurisdictions that we kind of work with.
Yeah, so certainly an appetite then for meeting with Summit County and or Park City.
Yeah, we're actually already scheduling or in the process of trying to schedule the meeting with the Summit County Council next. So
yeah, and transit, of course. Well, I mean, what are some of the other kind of regional issues that should be on that agenda?
I think it's the things that we wish we had been doing all along, of making sure that we're both aware of what the other one is doing within their own jurisdiction. You know, we've had some recent mismatches in the Jordan-L Basin compared to the Camas Valley area. And I think the more that we can communicate about issues like that, the more we can cooperatively tackle the problems that they create.
All right. Also, just a couple of items from the council's previous meeting. The meeting minutes note that the county received a C space bond request. What is that, and what did you approve administratively?
Yeah, so a CPACE bond request. This is the second request in my time that we've had. What these are is they're commercial energy efficiency bonds. Basically, the state allows an entity, like in this case, it was the Sky Ridge Hotel, to be able to borrow money against the property to upgrade the quality of the construction so that it's more energy efficient. And so the first one we did was at the Black Rock Resort. And so this allows them to install things like better insulation, more efficient heating systems or cooling systems or things like that, and borrow the money necessary to install those upgrades.
So why is it that the county has to be involved? They can't get these bonds on their own?
Yeah, I think because it ends up in the stack of how, if it were unpaid, it would end up in the stack of what happens if the property were to be liquidated, and the county, as the arbiter over property taxes, has a role in saying, yes, we're comfortable at least that those are subordinate to these other property tax considerations, but maybe above some of the other things like liens or other things like that might be placed against the property in the future.
Okay, so county taxpayers aren't on the line for this. These properties are putting up their land, essentially.
Yeah. It's just like taking out a mortgage against your own home. But in this case, it's more specific on these energy efficiency improvements.
Okay. Let's see. What's the latest with the Heber City property purchase of the county administration building?
Yeah, so we talked about that with the Heber City Council. I think we're interested in still pursuing it. Right now, Wasatch County Council has expressed an interest in ensuring that the county's piece of this block remains in some kind of civic use. I think for as long as Heber City has been around, this block has been courthouses and jails and really kind of uses, and we would like to see that stay as much as possible. So we're kind of talking through of what's the best way to do that, and how do we cooperate with Heber City? And they, I think, shared some really reassuring perspectives to the county council about what their plans are for how to activate this space as part of downtown while remaining accessible to the public. And so I think it's an ongoing conversation. I think we plan to also sell the old Heber City Fire Station, but there are just some intricacies we need to work through with that. Right now we're using it for storage for our fire station, and we may need to examine any commitments that have been made in the past.
Okay, so when do you expect that to be finalized?
At least the fire station, I think we're hoping in the next few weeks, actually, that we can work out a deal to transfer that property. Heber City recently bought the Heber Light and Power building immediately adjacent to it. And so we're kind of hoping that one's quicker. The administration building, I think, might take just a little bit longer because it's got a little bit more nuance to that negotiation.
All right. Let's talk wildfire. It's dry as a bone out there, and no measurable rain, I think. And it's been a month or so. Certainly, we're headed into fireworks month. What precautions, if any, is Wasatch County taking?
So we actually adopted earlier this year firework prohibitions in anywhere in the county, basically outside of very specific places within some of the municipalities. So like Charleston, I think still it plans on launching their own fireworks, but largely we're trying to discourage the public from the use of fireworks, except in these kind of safer places inside the parks and other things like that in Heber City and Midway. We also do some proactive things. Our fire district is going out and they do some urban wildlife interface programs where they encourage people to clear out around their houses and to make firewise improvements to their property.
Yeah. Any concerns with cuts to federal funding for the Forest Service that Wasatch County could be on its own to fight any fire that might break out?
I mean, yes and no, in that we've expressed some concern to local federal authorities about, we feel like we need this level of investment in the Forest Service, specifically not just in fighting fires, but also in the proactive measures that they use. The timber sales that go on in the forest are an important part of clearing out some of the underbrush. And so, yeah, there is some concern. I think we don't expect, Wasatch County is not out on its own. The state has its own set of resources, and we participate in the state's program so that we can call upon help from other agencies. We hope to not need it, but we are prepared if we do.
Okay, I wasn't going to bring this up, but I did see in the minutes that one of your council members, Kendall Crittenton, certainly who is entitled to his own opinion, kind of called out our Wasatch County reporter last meeting for her headline that Wasatch County is ignoring the state's new redistricting law. Both you and Mr. Crittenton have said that there will be no consequences for Wasatch County to ignore the law because you've been assured that it will be taken care of in this fall's interim session. And I guess what we're hearing from the public, and I guess what is upsetting to the public, is that it feels like Wasatch County blatantly ignoring a state law, that it's not any big deal and it's going to be fixed. But, you know, we just talked about laws, you know, in place for fireworks and open flames. I mean, and it's to state the absurd. I mean, should we just ignore them because it's going to snow in December?
I think a key difference there is that this law was never intended to affect Wasatch County. That was very clear from the state legislature from the very beginning. And again, for better or for worse, they were targeting Summit County and did not realize that this had any impact on Wasatch County. And ever since that moment, when they did enact these changes, they have assured us that it's going to be changed. So we do intend that those firework restrictions actually affect people's decisions. It was intended that they would curb the type of dangerous uses. This bill is not intended to enact a change in Wasatch County, so I don't feel like there's really all that much mismatch in aligning with that legislative intent.
So is it fair to say that Wasatch County sees some laws as optional?
No. I think it's merely just a logical use of county resources, that this is a non-issue, really. I mean, it's something that was a mistake that's going to be fixed. Why would we spend resources doing something that would just be a waste? I think it's a very inefficient use of those resources.
All right. Let's see. During the meeting Wednesday, council will get its look at the first quarter financial report. Are you happy with what you see there?
Yeah, I think we had some slow starts, but just like Summit County, and I think we talked about last time, I hadn't seen the numbers yet. We have seen a little bit of an uptick in some of our sales taxes. I think overall we expect that we are on target with a lot of our projections, which, you know, we generally try to estimate conservative estimates of our expenses and also lower conservative estimates of our revenues. And overall, we're in a good financial position.
All right. E-bike ordinance was also discussed at the last meeting. Is this ready for approval?
Yeah, so what's happening on Wednesday is the county council is doing a first reading of some proposed changes to the e-bike regulations. Again, this is an attempt to try and come into alignment with the intent of Heber City and Midway City's already existing regulations and to not overstep anything that the state is already regulating. So it's some pretty modest changes, but ones we think are really helpful when it comes to enforcement of things like this.
All right, and now only type 1 e-bikes will be allowed on backcountry trails. That's basically pedal assisted, no throttle, and no faster than I think 20 miles an hour. So basically the e-motorcycles are banned from backcountry travel according to this?
Yeah, I think largely we wanted to make sure that those trails remain safe. And even if you're going at speed uphill on some of these trails, it can create some unsafe circumstances. So that's the intent behind that segment of the regulations.
Okay, and does the ordinance spell out a speed limit?
So we don't have a specific speed limit. We we do intend for the public safety to be able to enforce a prudent speed use. I think it's going to depend on the circumstances. What we talked about in our last meeting, and I expect we will talk about tomorrow, is the need to actually sign speed limits along some of the trail segments. I think there are obvious challenges when you're talking about backcountry of there are lots of points of access, and it's not necessarily reasonable that we could set specific speed limits in some of those areas. And alone, aside from that, is actually enforcing specific speed limits in some of those more rural places. You know, it's not like we don't have a bike patrol at the moment, and some of those things might present some challenges. We also don't want to set up unreasonable expectations about what Wasatch County is able to enforce.
Yeah, so if you're going to put up speed limit signs, what's the number going to read?
I think it will depend on the trail. You know, there are certain trails where, you know, there are more heavy pedestrian use that will probably have lower limits, and ones that are in more rural places that might be tolerable for higher ones. Those are honestly something we'll work with our engineers on a case-by-case basis of what aligns with that prudent limit.
Mm-hmm. Helmet wearing is regulated by the state. Will the county sheriff be enforcing helmets?
I think the sheriff is interested in enforcing any law and regulation that we do pass, but that's something why we've been coordinating with him. It's because much of the time it's a matter of resources. You know, we often have patrol deputies who are going from call to call and don't have time for other types of proactive enforcement. You know, that's a service level discussion that we can have with the county council, and I think will come up in these discussions about what we're hoping to do more than anything is be able to have these regulations in place, communicate to the public both what the state's regulations are as well as the local regulations. And we think just some public information will help people self-regulate them in a lot of these circumstances. And the most egregious is when we can kind of get law enforcement involved to help address those most dangerous of circumstances.
Okay. Let's see. Wasatch County Children's Justice Center, there's a request for proposal going out. What's happening here?
So we're looking to make an addition to our Wasatch County Children's Justice Center. This is a facility that built, you know, maybe a little over 20 years ago, largely with donated labor, donated supplies, donated land. And it's been something that community has really rallied around to support the mission of that facility. What we see now is just as our approach to tackling the issues that they deal with have evolved, it's become a more collaborative process between all of the stakeholders, and we need a larger meeting space in that facility that is separated from the space where we might be doing interviews or other business at the CJC. So what we're looking to is award the RFP actually on Wednesday to a construction firm to help, or an architect to actually establish how big and what exactly we need to be able to build to meet the needs of the facility.
Yeah, how much money are we talking about?
I think that's part of the question we want answered. We have a grant actually from the state, and the state has been putting out, you know, this is, as far as I'm aware, the first time the state is actually putting money into some of these facilities, and that some other counties are getting their first CJCs. So we have a grant for about $500,000 that we're hoping to be able to put into it by next July. We expect it to exceed that somewhat, but we also have a lot of donations that we've received. So it kind of depends on what the needs assessment comes back with, and then what we decide to do about that. If we do something more modest, I think we can stay within the existing resources. And there may be a time too, if it ends up coming back with a higher expense, we may put the call out for people willing to donate towards the improvements at the CJC.
Okay. Let's see, there's another ordinance on the agenda, the short-term rentals. Any issues with that? Or basically, the county's just fulfilling state law requirements?
I believe so. I mean, short-term rentals are always an issue, and particularly they affect not just the kind of the licensing and things around that, but the character of the neighborhoods. And Wasatch County, I think, has never really had an issue in being compliant with state code, but it's really just been an ongoing issue that every community deals with of how to regulate, how to enforce, and what's the most appropriate way to deal with some of these sticky issues.
Okay. Hey, what's the latest with regard to the county's investigation into the sheriff's office? Any news there?
Yeah, I think we're expecting to be able to wrap it up in the next few weeks. I know that Judge McKelvey has almost completed his interviews and begun writing his report. I don't have the details of those reports. We've largely left him independent to be able to, you know, do his investigation as he seems fit. And once we do have something back, we'll, depending on what the nature of that is, we'll then take the next steps.
All right. Do you anticipate that's going to be discussed in closed session, or will it be discussed in open session?
It depends. Again, you know, if there are things that warrant a closed session discussion, we may have a discussion on it. But I think ultimately there are, if not the entirety, at least pieces of that report that would be subject to public information requests. And so we expect that at least some of it, if not all of it, will be made public.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Dustin?
No, not today.
All right. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Well, the historic Echo Church hosting a lecture and live demonstration this Saturday. In the studio to tell us more, Summit County historian Sandra Morrison, along with the guest lecturer, Sonia Nordstrom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sandra, give us just a little bit of background. You started scheduling lectures for the summer now?
Yes, so the historic Echo Church is open every Saturday from 11 until 9, and we opened up for Memorial Day weekend, so we encourage everybody to come by. We also have a new traveling exhibition on display called Immigration, an American Story. Talks about the journey of those who cross the plains and the oceans to come to settle in the United States. And but I've also added to it talking about some local folks in Summit County and where they came from, and used some just wonderful photographs from George Beard, who was a photographer in Colville in the late 1880s and 90s, and then also A.J. Russell, who was the photographer for the Union Pacific Railroad, who took earlier 1860s, when, you know, there were a lot less people living in Summit County at that point.
Yeah. All right, so the historic Echo Church, I know in Echo, what's so special about it?
So it's actually going to be 150 years old next year. It was built in 1876. And, of course, Echo, at the mouth of Echo Canyon, is basically the gateway to Summit County and Utah. So, you know, it's the site of the Pony Express and the Lincoln Highway and the Mormon pioneers and mountain men and people that came to Utah pretty much came through that corridor. So there's a lot of history, and we try and, you know, touch on that a little bit with our exhibits downstairs at the church. And then the fact that the church, you know, was built in 1876 and pretty much looks exactly the same today, so you really can step back in time and you know, get a sense of the past.
Yeah, so is it used as a church now, or
no,
is it more of a museum?
Yeah, so when it was first built, it was actually used by a lot of different denominations, and by the turn of the last century, you know, a lot of the population had become Mormons, and so it was bought by the Mormon Church, and they used it until the 1950s, and then it sat empty for a number of years, and the townspeople of Echo in the early 1980s bought it from the Mormon Church because the place was just falling to rack and ruin, and they didn't want to see it disappear. Yeah. So it's owned by the local nonprofit. That's basically all the locals and other interested people in Summit County.
Okay, so tell us what's happening on Saturday then.
So on this Saturday, June 21st, we have a presentation, Uncovering Echo's Past with Canine Detectives. And Sonia contacted us and wanted to train her dogs on detecting of unmarked graves. And we're like, great, because obviously, you know, there's always the urban legend about that there's unmarked graves in every cemetery, and a lot of discussion and Echo, of course, it would be about Chinese possibly buried in the unmarked graves. The Chinese built the railroad, the Transcontinental, which came through Echo. It was a hell on wheels town. And after the railroad was completed, you know, the railroad ties, wood, needed replacing. You know, every tie got replaced at least once a year, and there was a lot of other maintenance work, especially because it got built so quickly, that the section crews the Union Pacific started hiring Chinese, of course, with, you know, Americans or European bosses, white people. But so we had a large number of Chinese living in Echo. In the 1870s, we had a section crew of 15 Chinese. But by 1900, with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the workforce had shifted, and it was entirely Japanese, the section crew, yeah. And so...
So we know there are a lot of unmarked graves in the area, huh?
We assume there are.
Mm. All right. Well, so right. You'll be giving the lecture. Maybe just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Sure. I started with a search and rescue canine group 30 years ago. And I'm now training dog number 7. And as that has evolved, I think I started like most handlers, I'm going to rescue the 7-year-old out of the woods. And then that mission over time... With satellite, I mean, I started, we were maps and compasses, no cell phones, no pagers, and now things have evolved into satellites. So my mission has gone deeper and deeper into decedents only. I'm a retired FBI agent, so I've done lots of criminal work. I worked a dog while I was employed with the FBI in Los Angeles and with the evidence response team. So I'm still involved. I am president of Great Basin Canine Search and Rescue, which is a volunteer 501c3 canine group. We've taken our team toward only locating decedents because that's typically what the calls are for.
Right. And explain a little bit about that, because usually when you send out a search dog, the dog's got a recent scent. I mean, we're looking for somebody who just went missing, usually. Now we're talking about 150 years ago. I mean...
Yeah, so interestingly, the lecture will be discussing the various types of search dogs. People think of avalanche dogs, disaster dogs, wilderness air scent dogs. The trailing dog is what you're... When the air scent dogs go out, they're looking for any human odor in their path. So when you go out to cover a mountain, you may send trailing dogs, tracking dogs that are looking for a scent specific of one individual, or you may send them that are basically coursing the air, like more of an upland game dog looking for a bird, right? They don't have to know the specific bird they're looking for. When it goes to human remains, we're training the full spectrum of human odor decomposition all the way down to very, very old dry bone. So we start, and I just got back from a body farm last weekend training in Colorado. There are very few of them. This is the one at highest elevation in the U.S. And most people in this portion of the country, we have a much more varied, environment than you have in the Southeast, which is where most of the body farms are located. So the bodies all decompose at different rates in different ways. About 14 years ago, I was included with a group called History Flight that goes to Europe to recover World War II remains. And they've recovered many also on the island of Tarawa, which I've never been to Tarawa, but they support what used to be JPAC, which is the Joint Power, missing basically soldiers. So I made 4 trips to Europe looking for what were considered unrecoverable soldiers. And this group is amazing. They go with it's a multidisciplinary approach with archaeologists and geologists and all these PhDs and really, really smart people. And they do a lot of research. And so that's how I sort of went into this. And in preparation, I stopped in at Echo Cemetery to say, let's practice on what's very old.
Yeah. So what is it that, I mean, in the terms of the training, the dog, you need to have old bones?
Yes.
And where do you get those?
Donation and collection over 30 years. And there actually were places where people were purchasing them. Interestingly, many from China, which I don't typically work those, but oftentimes you get donations, either surgical donations, or you get even some victim families, when their loved one is found, they'll donate some bones. And interestingly, a bone doesn't have to necessarily be old, depending upon the way in which it has degraded over time. So something in a hot Mojave sun will be much like something that's been sitting for many, many years. But the only way to simulate the clandestine grave and the burial If we try to simulate it, we're disturbing the soil, which adds all kinds of other odors. So to try to go and find these old, unmarked places, and many cemeteries in this area have that, so that's where I've sort of taken it. So when I reached out to Echo, I give a few workshops every year, and I had a skilled group of handlers from Oregon, Washington, and California coming out. So I reached out and said, hey, do you mind if we spend a half a day there? And the temperature was perfect, and the conditions were perfect, and that plays a big part in it.
Yeah. Who would have thought that bones have a scent to them?
Yes, they do.
And would it be different than, I mean, than a deer carcass? I mean,
yes,
the dog.
No, Yes, it is. So we purposely proof the dogs, is what the term is called, against indicating on animal remains. And so when we're training up in the Uintas, there's animal remains all over the place. I saw a deer leg up in a tree from who knows what brought it up there. But and interestingly, they don't indicate it. So that's part of their training, is to differentiate the two. And anecdotally, this may not correlate at all, but I think you can probably walk into a kitchen and tell when it's beef versus pork versus chicken that's cooking. So theoretically, that's maybe one way to think of it, that it is different.
All right, so what type of breed of dogs do you use for this?
I'm a pointy-ear fan. There's sort of the floppy-eared crew and the pointy-eared crew. They're all very good, but I use Dutch Shepherds. I had, my first was a dog that didn't make it, and then I had a German Shepherd, and then I went to Dutch Shepherds. And so now I'm working my fifth Dutch Shepherd, and it's basically like the military Malinois, but it's dark and striped.
Ah, okay.
Very high drive. Kind of a machine, not necessarily fun to live with.
So do you just, you work with one dog at a time?
At
then?
A time, yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. Sounds pretty interesting. Tell us again, I know it's at the church, but what time is the lecture?
Yeah, so Saturday, June 21st, and it starts at 4 o'clock. The church, the doors will open at 11 in the morning, so, you know, please do come early. If you come a couple of hours earlier, you can wander through the church and look at our traveling exhibit and our permanent exhibits and wander around the cemetery as well. And then, of course, part of the talk will also include a demonstration in the cemetery as well.
We'll have a PowerPoint and then a furry PowerPoint. That's what we call it.
Okay, and again, we'll see the dog in action.
Hopefully. Yeah. It's going to be kind of hot, so we'll see how he does. Conditions are a big deal.
Yeah. Okay, anything else you want to mention?
No,
what else
and
you
again,
got planned?
And so we have another lecture coming up on in July and another one in August, mm-hmm. So stay tuned. And if you do come by the church, you know, leave us your email, and so then we can send you emails to remind you. And, of course, we have a Facebook page as well. And we hope to see people at the church this summer.
Okay, Sandra, Sonia, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
As we've reported, Summit County and Park City have offered Recycle Utah a 4-acre site at the Gilmore property off of US 40 for a potential new site for a recycling center. In the studio with an update, I have Recycle Utah General Manager Jim Bedell. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Leslie.
So does Recycle Utah want the lot? It's valued at like $7 million.
Well, let me answer that question by backing up a little bit into what we've been focusing on at Recycle Utah for the last year or so. I think, as everybody knows by now, we've discovered that despite the good efforts of organizations like ours and many others, we as a community send far too much material to the landfill. I mean, each and every year we send thousands of tons of waste to our landfill that doesn't belong there. Things that can be easily diverted, reused, composted, recycled. And our organization's focus is on making sure that as a community, we can make the proper investment so that we can intercept those materials, keep them out of the landfill, and avoid the environmental and financial penalties we pay by sending materials there that don't belong there. So that's been our primary focus, and we've been working pretty extensively over the last year or so to articulate a plan as to how you do that. You know, materials don't just get up and move from your garage to the International Paper facility to be made into new cardboard boxes. You know, you need an infrastructure to collect those materials, to process those materials, and that is our focus. And we are dedicated to partnering with Summit County, Park City, any other organizations that would care to be involved, to invest in the type of infrastructure we need to keep material out of the landfill. So in that context, as I think people know by now, we undertook a pretty extensive series of conversations and studies last year, starting with Recycle Utah and our 34 years of expertise in handling materials here, Summit County's own solid waste department, which has its own decades of experience managing both the landfill and diversion operations, and we brought in some outside consultants to advise us on the best way to do that. And that plan was one that we developed in partnership with all these other organizations, presented to the community earlier this year. It requires a much more significant investment, both in terms of land and, most importantly, money, than was contemplated in this proposal you alluded to. So it's not as simple as saying, do we want this valuable piece of land or not? The question is, you know, is that type of property appropriate for building the infrastructure we need?
Yeah, so how much land would you need to build your...
The recommendation, depending on, you know, there are a couple of different options for how we approach this issue, whether we, you know, go all in and make the full investment that would give us the best chance of success, or if we decide to take maybe a smaller investment. But in either case, you're looking at 5 to 6 acres of land and a structure to process materials of anything from 20,000 to 30,000 square feet, and the price tag for that is $25 million.
All right, so we're not too far off. I mean, 4 acres is a good start to getting to 6 acres if you eventually needed that.
I guess it depends on whether or not 4 acres can grow to 6 acres.
No, but I'm just saying it's like you need a place to put the stuff, right?
Correct.
So you can certainly start small and grow from there.
Possibly. Well, actually, the one of the best developments that's happened in the last week or so was last Friday. We sent our operations and logistics team out to this site, Lot 4, as it's called at Gilmore, along with the county's solid waste department and their buildings and grounds people. So the right people who understand buildings, logistics, and they spent a good amount of time out there going through the property and starting to think about what could possibly be built out there. So the answer to your question is we'll see what that group comes back with. I think having looked at this pretty extensively is highly unlikely that anyone's going to conclude you can build the type of diversion infrastructure that's recommended on that small parcel of land. But this group hopefully will come back with some clever ways of thinking about that. It could be an interim solution, could result in a good place for Recycle Utah to move next July 1st when we evacuate our current location. I suppose it's not impossible that clever people can come up with a way of handling the full volume of material we need to handle out there.
Yeah, I mean, you've already got the equipment, so you could at least do what you're doing today and more, since you're going to have 5 times more room than you have currently.
Yeah, absolutely. There's probably no doubt that we could handle more material out there than we currently do on our half-acre lot right now.
Yeah, so what are the site's limitations? I mean, you say it's too small.
Size.
And that's for the Taj Mahal $25 million project.
Well, Taj Mahal is probably an extreme version. If you've ever toured any of these, you know, facilities, we're talking about a warehouse structure. We're not talking about anything in terms of fancy infrastructure. And the reason the price tag is relatively low is you're building a warehouse. You're not building a Taj Mahal.
Okay. But you couldn't start with a small warehouse and then add on to a warehouse eventually?
You could. I guess the issue, and we'll see what the experts think about this, is if you need 6 acres, it's tough to see. Well, first of all, it's not 4 acres. That's the total lot size. But as you've heard, I think, from various county people recently, the useful portion of that land is significantly less than 4.18 acres. It's got a big hill on one side of it. It has some other issues about retaining ponds. So the real issue is if indeed the expert advice is correct. And, you know, keep in mind, too, you know, we also toured other facilities in the Mountain West where people are well ahead of us on this. And the first piece of advice you get from every one of them, whether you ask for it or not, is don't build it too small. So if you start off on a smaller piece of land and you have no adjacent land to expand to, you're constrained.
So is there another larger lot out there?
I mean, there's a lot of land in the county. We've spent time looking around at various options. I mean, we're not afraid in this organization to think kind of crazily and outside the box, and anybody who comes to our facility day after day can appreciate how we're willing to be sort of creative. There's nothing that's been identified at this point. And frankly, that's not really our area of expertise. I would defer more to the county and also the city. I mean, the city needs to take a greater role in this as well. And I was pleased to hear they had a meeting last Thursday to start discussing this topic. But those are the organizations that are probably better equipped to decide where land is available and what type of land they want to make available for this facility.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the numbers, because I'm hearing two different things. I'm hearing we've got a 12% diversion rate, and that's, I think, the number I hear from Recycle Utah. Parks City Municipal, in its staff report, talks about a 26% diversion rate. So what is it?
Sure. I'm not familiar with the details of their number, so I can't comment on that at all. I can tell you about how we came up with a 12% number. And it's based on the same type of analysis that the EPA uses and most other communities use to determine their diversion rate. And the analysis is fairly simple. You start with a denominator that's equal to all the waste. And in Summit County, the best source of information for that is our own solid waste management department. You know, most of the waste, not all, most of the waste in the county goes directly out to the landfill. So they were able to pretty easily provide us with that denominator. The numerator, then, is what you divert. And that's where people often have challenges, is trying to figure out who is diverting materials and trying to quantify the amount. So we're fortunate, again, here in the county, in that by far the biggest diversion source is the county's own curbside facility program, and the county gave that information to us. County also collects an increasingly impressive amount of material directly at the landfill that they divert, so they have that data. Obviously, we know the Recycle Utah data. And one thing we did that apparently others haven't done is ask the question of ourselves is who else is diverting material? You know, who else is collecting stuff? And the answer is the commercial haulers. People like Ace, Republic, Momentum, and we also talked to the smaller people, Recyclops, Good Earth. And we took the, I'm gonna resist the temptation for a little sarcasm here, but we picked up the phone, we called them, we said, hey, we're interested in calculating diversion rates, would you guys share your volume with us? And they said, yeah. So the 12% number we have includes everything, well, I would say everything, because there's always holes in the data, but information from everyone who is collecting significant amounts of material. So we're highly confident in that rate. It has a margin of error. We could be anywhere from 9 to 15%.
Yeah. So Recycle Utah could do what it's doing today. Why the, I guess, pushback here that it's like, well, we're not, we've got to move. But why the pushback into just doing what you're doing now in a bigger spot? Why does it have to be this big, giant, you know, collection and diversion center? Why can't it just be doing what Recycle's always done?
Well, I think the answer is, do you want to continue to be, you know, less than a third as efficient in diverting materials from the landfill as the rest of the country or not?
But perhaps with a larger, you know, place of business, you know, more people would come and drop stuff off. I think that's one of the limitations. It's like nobody wants to sit in line and have to, you know, take 10 minutes to back out of the center.
Exactly. I mean, it's exactly the rationale behind having a larger facility. I mean, anybody who's managed materials and landfill diversion will tell you it's not really a complicated process. Okay, you need to make it convenient for people to drop things off, and that could be a curbside. It could be a Recycle Utah-type facility that was less crowded. It could be conveniently located drop-off bins for major materials that are properly supervised. There's no great science for what you need to do here. You need to make it easy for people to do the right thing. The easiest thing right now is you drop it in the landfill, put it in the trash, and it goes away. You need to make it easier for people to divert things. And the second portion of that is you need to make it cheaper and more efficient to gather that material, process it, bale it up, and ship it out to the end users. Those are the two things. And in order to do the second part of that, which is the baling and consolidation, you need space. You don't just do that in a half-acre facility like ours. If we had a larger facility, could we do a little bit more, Leslie? Absolutely. But our goal is not to do a little bit more. I mean, we are so far behind. And as I don't know if you've heard this directly on your show, but if you listen to what the county landfill operators are telling you, that landfill has a limited life. And once it's full, not only are we going to have, you know, the unfortunate situation of not diverting as much as we should from an environmental point of view, we're going to be paying millions of dollars extra per year, according to the county's own analysis, to ship that waste elsewhere. So everything you can do to prolong the life of that landfill for environmental and financial gain, we should do. And doing something halfway is never the right solution.
Okay. It just doesn't feel like we're making any progress. Do you feel like you're making progress?
Progress will be a decision that we're moving ahead and we're breaking land. And we haven't done that yet.
Okay. Before we run out of time here, you've got your annual 100-mile meal tickets going on sale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we have a couple of exciting events to report today. Let me start. I'll just do this chronologically because that's how I've written it down. We have a facility tour of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District next Wednesday, June 25th, from 10 to 11:15 a.m. Free registration for that event is available on our website. So if you want to go see the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District's facility, sign up for that next Wednesday. July Green Drinks will be on July 8th this year in a very special event out at the Sage Mountain Animal Sanctuary in Piowa. This is a free event. I'm told it's great for families. The discussion topic will be water. We have a couple of great water experts, including someone who's going to talk about the Great Salt Lake. So that sounds like a really fun family event. That's also free, and register, please, on the website.
Aren't you charging for that now, just to make
sure? Some of the Green Drinks events, very good. Some of the Green Drinks events we are, because we provide food and beverages there. This one, I should have mentioned, and I'm glad you did, is bring your own food and beverages out there. So that's the reason there's no charge for this event.
And a little bit larger area.
Yeah, it should be a great area. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay.
And then, as you mentioned, the big event, on August 16th, we will have our 10th annual 100-mile meal event. It's at a very special location this year, the Mid-Mountain Lodge up at the Park City Mountain. Tickets will be available online later this week once I set them up properly. And they'll be $300 this year.
Okay. And how are you getting people to Mid-Mountain?
We'll be shuttling them up and down. There have been other events there. I haven't attended one myself, but the Park City Mountain people are pretty good at recommending the right type of shuttles to move you properly up and down, no matter what the weather conditions are.
Okay, Jim, anything else you want to mention?
No, thanks, Leslie. Good to talk to you.
Okay, talk to you next month. That's Jim Bedell, General Manager of Recycle Utah.